I'm Andy Tucker, the Acting Director at the University of Cambridge Centre for Gender Studies. And it's my great pleasure to introduce to you today's speaker, Professor Akbar Ahmed, the Chair of Islamic Studies at American University and the Diane Middlebrook and Carl Gerassi Visiting Professor at the Centre for Gender Studies during Michaelmas this year. Professor Ahmed is considered by many to be one of the world's foremost scholars of Islam and has published widely on Muslim societies around the globe. His more recent work is including the soon-to-be-published book The Thistle and the Drone, which focuses on the impact on Islam of the global war on terror. Today he'll be speaking about a particular facet of this work, and a facet that so far has been greatly underappreciated: the impact on women of the way tribal societies have been acutely affected and harmed as a result of a changing geopolitical order. So please join me in welcoming Professor Ahmed.
Thank you, Andy, for that very warm welcome, and of course for being the most hospitable of possible hosts. I would like to express my gratitude to Professor Carl Gerassi for instituting the visiting professorship in honor of his late wife, Diane Middlebrook, and the University of Cambridge Center for Gender Studies, especially Leslie Dixon, and to Jesus College for their hospitality. I would also like to convey the gratitude of my wife Zenith, Amine, Mina, who are delighted to be back in their favorite city, Cambridge. I see too many friends here to acknowledge them all, but I am delighted that they and you are with us this evening. I am especially pleased to see so many members of the community, including the distinguished scholar Dr. Tahir Kamran, my successor as the Iqbal Fellow, and Sir Nicholas Barrington, who was High Commissioner to Pakistan and remains a true ambassador between the two countries. So with that, let me plunge straight in. My talk will be in four parts. The first will present the conceptual frame. In the next section, I will discuss the traditional ideal type of Muslim tribal society. In the third, I will discuss the breakdown of the ideal type and its consequences for society, especially women. I will also discuss the role of women in Islam. In the final part of the talk, I will suggest ways to move forward out of the present predicament facing women. I do not pretend to have all the answers, but I hope that I can raise some relevant questions and stimulate discussion, certainly in the Q&A, and perhaps research in this crucial but neglected area of study. So, part one, let me explore how the war on terror that set out to capture or kill those behind the terrible and tragic events of 9/11 eventually became a war on tribal Islam, in particular against women. Now, this is a new way at looking at the war on terror. This is a new paradigm. So bear with me. We're going to be taking a long journey, complicated journey, and stay with me. I don't want you to get lost as we proceed. I will discuss the broader implications regarding the position of women in traditional tribal societies, where respect for elders included respect for women, and both played a key role in society. It gave women a defined role and security in society. I hope to draw a more complex picture than what is often seen regarding Muslim women in tribal societies. I will also show how the position of women is made worse by the breakdown of relations between the central government, the center, and tribal communities on the periphery. I will explore the idea that we can only understand the position of female suicide bombers by appreciating the cultural milieu that they were situated in prior to outside intervention and are now situated in as a result of this intervention. Simply put, these women are left without traditional structures of male protection and find their own agency as a result of the most heinous crimes severely limited. This is not to defend what they do, that is suicide bombing. I want to underline that. I cannot defend violence of any kind by anyone. But it is to understand how we can try and limit it in the future. Without this understanding, we are all in trouble. East, West, North, South, Muslim, non-Muslim. As such, we need to offer solutions which are not simply to suggest we should repeat exactly what was in place before, but to offer other ways in which women's position is made resilient. While we can apply our conceptual frame to a range of tribal societies, and each is to be understood within its own cultural and historical context, our focus will be on four major tribal societies. These societies are within the theater of the war on terror and have been the target of repeated drone strikes. The Pukhtun, that's the largest ethnic group in the world. These tribes inhabit Afghanistan and Pakistan mainly, but they're spread throughout the world. So the Pukhtun, called Pashtun or Pathans, the Yemenis, the Somalis, and the Kurds. And the Kurds are spread throughout the Middle East, as you know, in several countries. They don't have their own homeland. They also are a very large population. So we are talking of tribes that may number something like 30, 40. In the case of the Pukhtuns, they could be up to 40 to 50 million people. So we're not talking of small tribal marginal communities. These are mainstream, quote-unquote, nations. These communities, like their fathers and grandfathers, like their mothers and grandmothers, before them lived according to an ancient code of honor, known through the behavior of elders and by oral tradition, transmitted for centuries from generation to generation. Anthropologists identified these societies as organized along the principles of what they called the segmentary lineage system. Clans and subclans with nesting attributes traced their ancestry back to a common, often eponymous, ancestor. Now, because everyone is related to everyone else, everyone goes back to the same ancestor. Women always are aware of this placement on the code and on the charter. So in that sense, they always have a place, a defined place in society. All four societies that I've mentioned have become embroiled in different ways in the war on terror. The central governments, which oversees a variety of these tribes, and some from the periphery would argue illegitimately. It's a very important point I'm making. The periphery does not always see the central government as legitimate. And we can discuss this in the Q&A. With the financial and military backing of the United States in the war on terror, the central government was now able to bomb, kidnap, humiliate, and in many instances, even rape people from the tribal societies within their own borders with impunity. For the tribesmen and women, this was total emasculation, total helplessness. Every moral boundary was now crossed. Every structure holding up society had collapsed. This study posits the argument that the poor and often violent relationship between central governments and Muslim tribal communities, already shaky, broke down after 9/11. As the United States and its allies hunted for Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan, along the northwestern borders of Pakistan, in Yemen, in Somalia, central governments found it convenient to locate terrorists living in the periphery among the tribes. Even those countries not directly involved with the war on terror now projected any demands for genuine rights or complaints about human rights in the periphery as potentially supporting terrorism. The lines between legitimate claims for broader citizenship rights and hyperbolic fictions were often blurred. Al-Qaeda was spotted sometimes erroneously among the Kurds in the Middle East, the Chechen in Russia, the Uyghur in China, the Rohingya in Burma, the Tausig in the Philippines, and the Fulani and Tuareg in West Africa. Just to give you an example. And now, if you think for a moment, I've really given you the span right across Africa and Asia. We are talking of the globe. In that sense, this global war is now forming into a global war focused on tribal societies. This war, this global war, has consumed the lives, imagination, and resources of societies across the world. The problem is, and I want you to think about this, it involves us here in Britain, the problem is that the genesis, taxonomy and the very epistemology of the war on terror are covered with an unusually dense fog. Disinformation, deceit, confusion, and sometimes plain ignorance compete with idealistic hopes and dreams of a new world order. To make matters worse, this entire war is framed unproblematically as a war of men, by men, and for men. If you recall, the drivers of the war after 9/11 were all men. George W. Bush, Dick Cheney, Donald Rumsfeld, Tony Blair, and so on in the West. Their partners in the Muslim world were men like President Musharraf, President Mubarak, and so on. So it really was a drama in which men played the central role. There were some women, they were very marginal, or in supporting roles of these particular men. So war by men, for men. And I must confess, they played havoc with the world. So we need women to be more center stage in the coming time. The impact of the war on women in Muslim tribal societies was and is rarely discussed. So in all this, we rarely heard of what was happening to the women in these very societies. We had reports from time to time in the press, so many militants killed, so many terrorists caught. We rarely, if ever, heard of women and the impact being made on women. If it was at all, women were reduced to simplistic categories. We can see this in two ways, in relation to Muslim women in the West and in relation to Muslim women among tribal societies. In each instance, women are positioned into binary extremes, which in some instances do not take account of the diversity of lived experiences. However, in other circumstances, the sad fact is that these extremes are currently a reality. The question in those cases, as I'll argue later, is the need to help create a middle ground. In relation to the West, a good example is the recently published book, and those of you who are making notes, Wanted Women, popular book written by an American author, Faith, Lies, and the War on Terror by Deborah Scroggins. Now, Scroggins creates two fundamentally opposed models of women after 9/11. One of these is symbolized by Ayn Hirsi Ali, who rejects Islam altogether. The other extreme is exemplified by Dr. Afia Siddiqui, who has been convicted and imprisoned, many would say incorrectly and unjustly, in the United States for supporting terrorism. Here it appears women can only exist at the margins, literally as placeholders at the extremes of a broader, misguided ideological struggle. While both these women, in fact, are intelligent, articulate, and driven by a desire to change the world as they see it, they form important strands in the discussion of Muslim women. They do. There is a strand which they reflect. But I believe there are other mainstream strands of Muslim women who have not been given the attention they deserve. By mainstream, I mean those women who are attempting to balance their traditional lives with their families in the face of the changed circumstances around them, which threatened violence, and they're responding with compassion, with good sense, and with immense courage. They're creating a middle ground for women. They neither reject Islam, like Hirsi Ali, nor advocate confrontation, like Dr. Siddiqui. I believe the majority of Muslims in Muslim society, both in the West and elsewhere, would fall in this category. Take some well-known examples. Just one internationally known example, Benazir Bhutto. I'm not talking of her politics. I'm talking of her as a woman representing mainstream society. And there are other women. Take the parliamentarians in Pakistan with all its problems, and it has huge problems, serious law and order problems. There's something like 70 women in parliament today, 70 women, and they have a voice and they demand a voice, and good luck to them. In the West, we see many examples of this mainstream woman. Dr. Ingrid Mattson, the first female president of the Islamic Society of North America. This is the largest society in North America on the continent. Dr. Rana Akbar, president of the All Pakistan Physicians Association of North America, 12,000 members, president. These women are making a huge impact, not just as women, but as mainstream figures. In the UK, we have so many examples, and I don't want to go into them, but you know people like Baroness Saida Warsi and Michelle Hussein, who hosts the BBC television and so on. Unfortunately, there is limited appreciation of this middle ground, and its impact and achievements are too often overshadowed by the extremes. There is, however, another social category, and little is known of it. I refer to women living in traditional tribal societies where the war on terror is being conducted, in Afghanistan, the tribal areas of Pakistan, Yemen, and Somalia. And these are just some tribal societies I'm mentioning. We could, as a rule, take the same paradigm and apply it right across the Muslim world where Muslim tribal societies exist. Here again, we find binary opposites in terms of popular narrative, which are perpetuated because these societies live in generally inaccessible and isolated regions, and conditions are understood to be dangerous for visitors. So to make matters worse for women, visitors aren't allowed there, or conditions are so dangerous that visitors are discouraged from even attending. There's thus far too little information about the conditions prevailing there. These binaries in relation to tribal areas are either, on the one hand, so these are the stereotypes, the binaries of these tribal women, passive victim, so they're seen as passive victim, or the suicide bomber. Once again, the mainstream is left out. Now, unlike the example of the binaries of Muslim women in the West, here we can, on some level at least, acknowledge these extremes as realities. However, drawing on my recent ethnographic work, I now want to go into detail as to why these extremes have come about and what can be done to help create, like exists in the West and some of the urban areas of the Muslim world, still underreported, some form of middle ground. So this is the part in which I talk about society, which creates conditions for women like this to emerge. So to understand some of the more complex realities that women and tribal societies face, it is first important to look at the customs, beliefs, leadership, political actions, and institutions of the tribes, a staple of anthropological interest, and how they are reflected in two defining features of tribal society: the sources of tribal authority and the code, with its emphasis on hospitality, on revenge, and honor. That's the basis of the code of honor. In my writings and research on Waziristan and other parts of the tribal areas along the borders of Afghanistan and Pakistan, begun in the 1970s and continuing through to today, I have developed a model describing how the different parts of society and their various sources of authority functioned and interacted with one another. The Waziristan model, it should be emphasized, is applicable to a great degree to other tribes in the tribal areas of Pakistan, and indeed, in significant ways, to other tribes of a similar nature elsewhere. I believe it is crucial to first understand the model as to then appreciate the role of women in tribal societies. So, the Waziristan model. Now, you know where Waziristan is. Some people are nodding their head this way, some that way. For those who are pointing this way, it is in Pakistan, the tribal areas of Pakistan, and according to President Obama, the most dangerous place in the world. He officially called it that. And that is the place which has been more struck by drone strikes than any other place on earth, Waziristan. There are three distinct, overlapping, and in some ways mutually interdependent, though often in opposition to each other, sources of authority in the model. The first source of authority, that of the tribal elder or malik. The second, that of the mullah or religious leadership. And the third, that of the political officers representing the central government. We may see them as the three pillars of authority. Each had a symbiotic relationship with the others and used them as a foil. The relationship among the three was inevitably in flux, changing, and dynamic. So you can see the three pillars and the tensions they invariably would create. Traditional authority, religious authority, and central government authority in the tribal areas of Pakistan. All three sources of authority are male. Muslim societies in tribal and rural areas are still male dominated. Women rarely, if ever, receive their due rights, for example, in inheritance, and are too often, tragically, the victims of the so-called honor killings. This is not to say that women do not play an important role in tribal societies. I want to emphasize this. Women are acutely aware, as I've said, of their placement on the genealogical charter. And that gives them status, and it gives them authority, and it gives them security. Much of the actions of women impact on honor killings. So women can, in one sense, guide society one way or the other. And this business of honor killings itself is all a function of how women behave in society. Dr. Amane Hoti, who is with us this evening, has written a book and given us insights into tribal societies and the role of women in them, pointing out that through the institution of Gham Khadi, which means literally funerals and weddings, sorrow and joy, women play a critical role in these societies. Women turning up at the funeral or not turning up immediately creates a sequence of actions in that community. So while outside we may feel women have a limited role, in fact women are playing a critical role within that society. But, and this is what I'm arguing, the breakdown of the relationship between center and periphery and simultaneously the traditional structure of society, the three pillars that I pointed out, they have broken down. The relationship between the center and periphery has broken down after 9/11 for all kinds of reasons. That breakdown has a consequence. And that consequence is that young men and women in the periphery are now organizing themselves into deadly groups to assert their authority and to take revenge against the onslaught of what they think is the battle for survival when the central government sends in its army and helicopter gunships into their areas. These groups are directly or indirectly affiliated to Al-Qaeda, and they include the TTP, the Tehreek-e-Taliban in the tribal areas of Pakistan, Al-Shabaab in Somalia, and Boko Haram in Nigeria. So again, you can see it's more or less the same pattern, except that we are crossing several continents in trying to explain it. Their primary target, and if you recall the model, the Waziristan model, the first pillar is lineage-based authority. The first target of these groups is lineage-based authority. If there was an American soldier and an elder of the tribe, they would kill the elder of the tribe first. Because if they demolish that structure of the traditional authority of the tribe, they are then free to fill the vacuum by their own authority. That is their primary target. In Waziristan alone, and these are very small populations, tribal societies are not like urban societies. They're not like the provinces in Pakistan, like the Punjab, which is a huge province. Pakistan's population is 180 million people. Punjab is, Dr. Tahir, what's the population of Punjab?
It's 62%.
Which is how much? My maths has always been weak. 90 million. I'm talking of small tribal populations. Waziristan, maybe 500,000 people. That's it. Now, out of this population, if you kill 400 elders, you have decapitated the tribe. Effectively, if you see the tribe as a body, the head is the lineage-based leader. And what the TTP is doing, or the Al-Shabaab or Boko Haram, they're killing the leaders of the tribe. They're decapitating it. And without the head, the body doesn't know which way to go even, loses direction. That is what's happening in these societies. 400 elders in Waziristan. In the tribal areas of Pakistan, 800 elders have been killed. These are devastating numbers when the population is so small, and these elders take literally generations to come into their own with their authority and their gravitas, which impresses people outside the agencies. Now, after 9/11, and I know this, I've been in touch with Muslim women, my wife, my daughters are all involved in this discussion. In the West, if Muslim women who wore the hijab sometimes faced hostility, sometimes even faced violence, the kind of challenge I'm talking about for women in the tribal areas is on a completely different level. I'm talking about women who are finding it difficult to survive. And I'll tell you how it works in reality. And again, remember what we're talking about. Pakhtuns, Yemenis, Somalis, Kurds. One day, American missiles. The next day, the central government sends in its army or helicopter gunships. The third day, suicide bombers walk into a community, walk into a mosque, walk into a school, blow themselves up and kill people of the community. The next day, the clan warfare, which continues. And finally, some of these women are left completely on their own. Their men have gone up into the mountains to hide or fight or take shelter or been captured or being tortured. They have barely enough to survive. They're very poor people. These societies are impoverished societies. So very often they pack their family just to ensure the safety of their children, and they turn up in some shanty town or some suburb of a city nearby. They have little money, they have few resources, and they're finding it just simply difficult to subsist. That is why women in this part of the world will say, every day is like 9/11 for us. America suffered on that day, but we suffer like this every day. Our lives are destroyed. And therefore, we need to reframe the famous quote of Gayatri Spivak. You may recall her quotation about women in the third world, defined as white women saving brown women from brown men. You can reframe that to say, brown men and women having to survive the onslaught of both white and brown men. So brown and white men combining for an onslaught on brown men and women. And that is the reality in these societies. In this reading, there's clearly a view that many, many individuals are barely surviving and are indeed victims of the most atrocious crimes. Let me now go into that a little bit so you have an idea of the extent of what is happening in Muslim societies. And bear with me, I know this is a genteel Cambridge crowd, Cambridge audience. You're going to hear some fairly gory stuff. And I have dozens of these case studies. I'm in the middle of a study, which is called The Thistle and the Drone, which is about to come up, be published in January. And one of my research assistants, Frankie Martin, standing at the back there, I see him. This study will give you dozens of cases of this kind, which caused many a sleepless night, certainly to me, and I know Frankie. His natural American optimism was a bit dented with that. Okay, here you are. In June, now follow this case very carefully. In June 2000, and this is from Chechnya, two teenage girls, 17-year-old Khava, the niece of a prominent Chechen leader, killed the previous year, and her best friend Luisa, age 16, became the first known Chechen suicide bombers when they drove a truck full of explosives into a Russian army base in their home village. Khava's cri de coeur expressed her anger and frustration in a pre-recorded video with Luisa and could be that of any other female suicide bomber. First of all, think of the age. These girls are as old as my granddaughter sitting there, Mina. That's the age. These are high school girls. What has driven them into becoming suicide bombers? Now, listen to the letter she leaves behind. Follow this letter. This is a letter she addresses to her sisters. She says, "Sisters, the time has come. When the enemy has killed almost all our men, our brothers and husbands, We are the only ones left to take revenge for them. The time has come for us to take up arms and defend our home, our land, from those who bring death to our home. And if we have to become martyrs, we will not stop. Our forefathers would have killed anyone who tried to touch their women. But today, Muslim women are getting attacked and raped in front of those who claim to be men. They have no sense of jealousy for the honor of their Muslim sisters. Honor to the extent that they sit at home and drink tea while listening to this appalling news. Do you consider yourselves men? This life is not worth anything. Every person will die and leave this life behind. So why do we not choose the best way to die, martyrdom, the highest, most eminent way? We have chosen this way for ourselves and hope you will choose this way too. Now, Khawa and Luisa's words demonstrate the place of women in the Chechen code of honor. The Chechen have their own code of honor called the Nokchala. And they illustrate how this code, which is not meant for suicide, had mutated with the destruction of traditional society. Now here's the big point I want to make. Traditional society does not promote violence or suicide. It's the breakdown which creates the mutation that creates the suicide bomber. It's a very important point I'm making. It isn't inherent to society. Under Nokchala, if a man takes the life of a woman or rapes her, male members of a family have the right to kill two members of the offender's family. Khawa and Luisa's anger is directed as much against the Russians, whom they accuse of rape, as much as against their own men who they blame for failing to defend their honor. The bloodshed that followed Russia's brutal attempts to crush Chechnya's bid to secede after the collapse of the Soviet Union threw Chechen society into ferment. In all, Russian operations in Chechnya after 1994, this is just a couple of years ago, killed around 100,000 Chechen. That is 10% of the entire population. 10% of the population wiped out. In November 2001, Eliza, a 23-year-old woman who had lost 16 members of her family, 16 members, including a husband, two brothers, and a cousin, to the Russians. Now, listen to this story. She walked up to the Russian general Gaidar and asked, "Do you still remember me?" She then blew herself up, killing the general and his bodyguards. Prior to this incident, Gadiyev had personally summoned her to witness her husband's torture and execution. This included the general slashing open the stomach of her husband and forcing Elsa's face into the gaping wound. Out of a total of 110 Chechen suicide bombers who launched strikes between 2000 and 2006, 47 were women. And studies have shown that nearly all of these women lost at least one relative in the war. Some had been raped, others kidnapped and tortured. While some were linked to groups such as the one led by the Chechen leader Basiyev, a great number of the suicide bombers had no organizational links at all. We can see that this is problematic in and of itself. The frequency of the suicide attacks and their geographical span, and I want to confirm that we have case studies spanning the continents. And I want to emphasize again that this is a new phenomenon. There is no recorded incident of female suicide bombers in this manner and in this frequency before the last decade or so. This is something new that's happening in society. It's a breakdown. It's a mutation of traditional society and of Islam, and I'll come to Islam in a moment. Now, this story should have alerted us that something has gone horribly wrong in these societies on the periphery, and the failure of their central governments to deal satisfactorily with them. In response to the actions of the tribes on the periphery, the central government, that is the third pillar, if you recall, third pillar of the Waziristan model, has responded with unthinking brute force, which in routine includes rape, and in some cases, even abets cannibalism. This is the state responding to the periphery. Despite the fearsome reputation of the tribes throughout history and their code, revenge is taken to satisfy honor and not to commit murder for its own sake. The whole notion of the code is a very finely tuned body of action and reaction. It isn't to run wild and go around shooting people, because that would be a breakdown of society. And these societies have perpetuated themselves for centuries, and they are on the verge now of breaking down. The elders, for example, would want to maintain the code. The religious leaders would want to constantly appeal to calm, to reconciliation, and to making sure that there's stability in society. That is the role of the mullah or the religious figure in Muslim society, not to incite violence. So the actions of these suicide bombers in their indiscriminate killing are thus devoid of both tribal honor and religious compassion. In their actions, they are negating tribal honor and their own Islamic religion, because Islam, by definition, would not support their actions. The fact that many of the suicide bombings are conducted by women, whose protection is considered a matter of honor for the tribesmen, is further evidence of the devastation wrought on the community, with too many of the women being raped and their husbands arrested, tortured, or killed. Now, let me make a brief comment on women in Islam, and I'm sure you'll be interested in this. It's always a popular subject, and people have lots of questions. We can only understand the depths of the dilemma faced by the individual in society when we measure the suicides against the ideal in Islam. Suicide is not only categorically prohibited in Islam, because, as in other faiths, like Christianity, only God gives and takes life, but the idea of female suicide is especially reprehensible. Women in the ideal in Islam have the highest possible status, both theologically and sociologically. Women in Islam had rights to inheritance, to initiate divorce, and play an active role in religious, social, economic, and public life in the 7th century when Islam came. That was Islamic law as and when it came in the 7th century. Such dreadful practices as honor killings and female circumcision, while practiced in Muslim tribal societies, are not sanctioned in Islam. The sayings of the Prophet and his behavior towards women confirmed their high position. They not only held the family together, but the example influenced the young generation as the values of their society were passed on it. When asked the best way to reach paradise, the Prophet thrice replied, "Under the feet of the mother," pointing to the importance of the elevated position of the mother as a childbearer and central figure in the family. So three times when the Prophet was asked by a Muslim, an impatient Muslim, I may add, and Muslims remain very impatient, you can see that. This impatient Muslim came to show me a shortcut to paradise, and he said, the Prophet said, be devoted to your mother, be nice to her, be gentle to her, be compassionate to her, because you will find paradise under her feet. A metaphor. This fellow went home, thought about it, came back next day and said, show me another shortcut and get some strange relationship with women. And the Prophet said again, under the feet of the mother. Three times he repeated this. So for Muslims, this is a lesson. We have to understand this lesson. The Prophet's household provided some of the greatest role models for Muslim women. And the paradox is that all these female suicide bombers would have known these examples. These are examples that Muslim society knows by heart, as it were. These are great names: Khadija, Aisha, Fatima. These are noble women, courageous women, bold women, scholarly women, and their contribution to history has been immense. So the suicide bombers would have known these women, and yet in their act, they have chosen to reject that particular model of Islam and adopt violence. Because I believe something is going terribly wrong in Muslim tribal society. That is the conclusion. And it is this breakdown that creates a binary of passive victim and, at an extreme, the suicide bomber. Again, I want to clarify and underline, this is not to justify, but this discussion hopefully will illuminate why women feel driven to such an extreme. For us, the challenge is, how to create the mainstream or the middle ground. That is our challenge. So let me now move to the last part of my talk. Much can and needs to be done to ease the burden on women. First and foremost is to acknowledge the importance of education. In the tribal areas of Pakistan, male literacy rates are 4 to 5%. For women, it is virtually zero. Now, this is completely unacceptable by any standards. And if Pakistan has any pretense at being a modern state, it needs to do something urgently about education in the tribal areas. And you can see a correlation here. The most turbulent area, called the most dangerous place in the world, almost zero education literacy, the highest number of drone strikes. Some kind of correlation. Some future PhD thesis for the bright youngsters sitting here. This is unacceptable. It is unacceptable to Pakistan, to its neighbors, to the friends of Pakistan, like Sir Nicholas Barrington, and he needs to tell us what he's done about this after we finish talking. He's smiling there. Now, I want to make a comment here about education in Islam. There is a stereotype that Muslims don't appreciate education. They denigrate it. They have little time for it. On the contrary, let me reiterate that education has the highest place in Islam, theologically. It's the word ilm for knowledge, ilm means knowledge, is the most repeated in the Quran, the holy book of the Muslims, after the word for God. And there's verse after verse in which God tells Muslims to acquire knowledge. There's a saying of the Prophet, and I find it a very powerful saying, and I wish every Muslim knew this saying. And I wish non-Muslims knew of it. The ink of the scholar is more sacred than the blood of the martyr. It's a very powerful saying. And Muslims, unfortunately, have reversed this. They have made the blood of the martyr more important than the ink of the scholar. And when I give you the figures for the tribal areas, you will understand how Muslims themselves have rejected this most basic exhortation of the Prophet of Islam. The ink of the scholar is more sacred than the blood of the martyr. Let me give you an example from tribal society, because you may say this is all ideal talk. It doesn't exist in real life. The Wali of Swat, the ruler of the state in North Pakistan, in the 1950s and 60s, he created hundreds of schools, free, compulsory girls' schools. So you wanted to send your daughter or not, you had to send her to this girls' school in Swat. He sent his own grandchildren, and here he broke all tradition. Remember, this is the country, the area, the region, which will be taken over by the Taliban a couple of years ago, if you recall this historical development when Hillary Clinton, the Secretary of State, was alarmed because the Taliban were now 60 miles from Islamabad, the capital of a nuclear armed state, Pakistan. That is Swat. And the Wali of Swat sends his granddaughters to a convent, the Jesus and Mary Convent, run by Catholic nuns. And he invites the nuns to Pakistan, to Swat, where they set up a convent. Now, of course, when he dies, the Taliban come, the Taliban take over, and guess what their first target is? The girls' schools. And the convent. That's their first target. But we need to take heart, because just day before yesterday, you may have heard of this tragic shooting of Malala Yousafzai, whose family we know and we work with. What you need to take heart is that here in the midst of that very tense society is a 14-year-old girl prepared not to back down, prepared to demand her right to be educated, prepared to remain as a citizen of the modern world, blogging on the BBC, standing up to the Taliban, and attempting to create a better world for herself and her society. And again, I say tragically, because the Taliban have not only shot her, but have said, we are not going to leave her even when she leaves the hospital. The good news is that the reaction in Pakistan has been overwhelmingly for her. There's been a strong outpouring of support for her. So as a teacher on campus, I cannot overstate the importance of education in Muslim society. But we need practical schemes and suggestions for women in these areas, impoverished areas, to empower them. Microfinance credit schemes to fund projects for women in small-scale industry. Women need to be encouraged to participate in local government elections, in local elections, in national elections. Talks, lectures, conferences, exchanges, all this must be vigorously pursued. Now, I want to make a slightly controversial point. And the point is, how much do we in the Muslim world rely on Western aid? There's a debate that we are now independent, we don't need your aid. I don't accept that. I believe that countries like the United States, like the UK, have been incredibly generous friends of these countries. Even Pakistan. The United States gives billions of dollars to Pakistan. The UK gives billions of dollars to that entire region. And these countries can help immensely in supporting the kind of institution in these countries that ultimately would create more young girls determined to get education. So that within society, there's a resistance to the men of violence. Within society, there's education, there's enlightenment, there's progress so that these societies take their rightful place in the community of nations. This cannot be done on their own, I can assure you. I can tell you because I have been educated at a school called Burn Hall in North Pakistan. It was run by the Catholic priests, one of the best schools in Pakistan. And then I went to Foreman Christian College, run by American Presbyterians in Lahore. Again, it's produced, in my time, at least two presidents. And generations of foreign ministers and ambassadors and members of parliament. Now, if we can have the aid being given so generously by the West diverted into colleges like Foreman Christian College, it can make a huge impact not only on the people attending these colleges, but outside society itself, anyone interacting with these people, the people coming out of colleges like that. We need to think about this. Too much of the aid is short-term. Too much of it just disappears. Too much is unaccountable for. And if you don't believe me, just check up from my wife what the prices are for houses in Islamabad. After 9/11, they've shot up, they've gone through the roof because there's so much money around. So people will tell you Pakistanis are starving, Somalis are starving, Yemenis are starving, and people will tell you, but the elite has so much money. They've literally got so much money you can't believe where the money is coming from. Something is going wrong somewhere. I believe that if this aid is finally focused and clauses are installed in the agreements, that this aid goes exclusively for 50% goes for education. That's it. Colleges, schools, and we need to see results. You will see the impact on society very, very quickly. As it is, I've given you the exact picture in the tribal areas of Pakistan today, where after billions of dollars of aid from the West, today you have a situation of complete turmoil. You have over 100,000 Pakistani soldiers there. There's bombing, killing, suicide bombers every day. And how this is going to be solved, I have no idea. And I don't think anyone else either. So we need to be thinking long term. We need to be thinking holistic. So let me conclude. So I have provided an idea of tribal society of the segmentary lineage system variety. I've identified the importance of the lineage, the code, and the main source of authority and what can be termed the Waziristan model. Pakistan's invasion of tribal areas, the destruction of the civil administration, and as a consequence, the near collapse of governance in Pakistan, combined with the relentless American drone strikes and pressure to do more, which forced the Pakistan army into repeatedly assaulting the tribal areas, pushed the Waziristan model towards destruction. The TTP moved in for the kill. The TTP, you recall, are the very violent branch of the Taliban in Pakistan. And they really spare no one. They will go into a mosque, they will go into a school, they will go into a community, and they'll blow them up. It makes absolutely no sense. They defy the traditional code of honor. They defy any Islamic, any Islamic injunction for compassion, stability, justice. But they are there, they're out there, and they need to be tackled. So the conclusion is clear. In order to check and eliminate the TTP and other groups like it and to prevent similar future eruptions, this model has to be painfully, slowly, but surely recreated with, of course, suitable adjustments for proper democratic enfranchisement. But I'm not advocating a simple return to the past. The reconstruction of society gives us the opportunity to empower women and ensure their protection and their right to education and every other facility that the state provides to its male citizens. This will allow women in the tribal areas to create, to expand, and to consolidate the middle ground. We also need to keep in mind that without repairing the damage between the center and the periphery, nothing very much will work. And this is something I would urge you in the West to consider very carefully. We see these societies as all legitimacy resting in the state. We often forget that these states were created 50 years ago, 60 years ago, and many of these were created by colonial officers in London and Paris, sitting with maps and a ruler and a pen and drawing lines right across Africa and Asia with no regard for tribes or ethnic groups, slicing them in half. The Kurds sliced into five nations, the Pakhtuns into two nations, Somali into half a dozen nations. Now what does that do to those people? The two brothers who lived together, ate together, are suddenly divided into two families across the border and they can't visit each other. When India and Pakistan were divided in what was East Pakistan, the line went right through a railway station. The platform was in one country, the ticket office in the other country. No comments on the way the British divided the subcontinent. Don't read anything into it. So, let me sum up. I have argued for the need to appreciate the complexity of the role of women in traditional societies undergoing turmoil as a consequence of the war on terror, and to challenge the binary extremes they have been reduced to. I've also suggested the way forward to empower women in traditional tribal societies. The situation as it exists today, I believe, cannot be allowed to carry on. Thank you.
We have some time for questions now. If anyone wants to ask Professor Ahmed anything about the talk. I actually have a question to kick off with, which is that you speak a lot about the impact on women in a kind of top-down kind of way. And you also mentioned that obviously the situation for women in more urbanized areas is significantly better. What do you think the chances are for solidarity between women in tribal areas and women in more formalized urban areas to try and affect change?
Well, Andy, that's one of the hopeful signs that I see, that there is developing a great awareness of a women's movement without calling it such. There is an awareness that women have been left behind, they need to get their rights, and that they need to be part of the dialogue and the narrative. That's a hopeful sign. Women are not, I've once constantly told about women in the Muslim world as being very submissive and being very much in being kicked around by their men and so on, and that's the stereotype, men walking and women walking three steps behind. Now, anyone who knows my wife or my daughter or my granddaughter will know that that's absolutely, Naila's laughing because she knows her, it's absolute nonsense. These women have a very strong role and personality. It's the institutions that have collapsed, which makes their role impossible. It's not the traditional structures which gave them a certain role and certain protection, a certain dignity. It's the traditional societies that I've been talking about which are now breaking down and which have exposed them. And in that situation, not only men, women are equally vulnerable. So it's not only the women we are talking about, men are also vulnerable in this. We should be careful for purposes of analysis, we are making all these categories. Men, young men are equally vulnerable to the kinds of things I'm talking about.
and then equally susceptible to being caught up in this dreadful sequence of suicide bombing.
Thank you very much. Excellent talk and very evocative too. And I just wondered, you describe the relationship between the central governance structures and also the tribal areas. And what hope do you see in the current central governance for the kinds of changes that you think need to happen in order to change things?
You know, this is such a central question, the relationship between the center and the periphery, and I find it very difficult to convince my friends in the West that there is a problem, because legitimacy really rests in the center as far as the West is concerned. The state, the United Kingdom or the United States or France, is very solid. It's there. No one's suggesting it's about to collapse or disintegrate. The countries I'm talking about are newly formed. Some of them are very fragile. Pakistan itself, if you recall, broke into two in 1971. Nigeria almost broke. Indonesia had bits and pieces falling off. Sudan just broke into two. These are fragile states. They're held together by an idea of nationhood. Now, unless the center gives rights to the periphery, that periphery is not going to be happy. Now, paradoxically, in Pakistan, the founder of Pakistan, Mr. Jinnah, who Pakistanis call Qaid-e-Azam out of reverence and respect, he was a man of great vision. He first steps that he took towards the periphery were very, 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 quote-unquote, liberal. He pulled out the entire army from the tribal areas. This was unthinkable. The tribal areas had been the most difficult areas for the British. Waziristan, which I mentioned to you, and some of you hadn't heard of, Waziristan had more British troops in that area than the rest of the Indian subcontinent combined. You can see the scale of Waziristan. In the 1930s, they wiped out an entire British brigade. Unthinkable. This is the high noon of empire. So Jinnah just created Pakistan. He's got huge problems. And he reaches out to the tribal areas, pulls out the army, and sends a message to the tribal people. This is your country. I'm not going to send troops there to watch over you. You are now the defenders of this nation. And the tribes responded in spirit and kind. They became the defenders of Pakistan. Similarly, with Balochistan, he did exactly the same thing. Now, unfortunately, our rulers in Pakistan and in many other Muslim countries are not great readers of history, including their own history, because they're constantly making mistakes which they would not have made if they had read their own history. So today you have the army going in again and again into the tribal areas. You have the army operating in Balochistan. You have a situation in Balochistan which you may or may not be aware of. There's a simmering civil war situation in Balochistan. And it's very dangerous, because if Balochistan falls out of Pakistan, Pakistan will collapse. If that happens, the consequences for that whole region are enormous. Very few people are thinking about that. So we really need to be looking at the role of the center and doing everything we can here in the West, again, tactfully, diplomatically, it may not be politically correct, but to remind the center that it is its responsibility to treat the periphery, the citizens of that part of their country, with the respect, with the dignity that they deserve as citizens of that country, which they're not getting. And I'm not just talking of Pakistan. Take Iraq. Take Saddam Hussein, how he treated the Kurds. You can go right through these countries. You see what Assad is doing to his own citizens in Syria. They're just treating them like, I would say, worse than animals even. Now that has to stop. And that can only stop when we constantly remind them that that is illegitimate. It cannot be allowed. Now, how we can prevent it is something that we can debate on. If we are clear that there is a problem, it needs to be resolved, then we are at least one step forward into solving it. Right now, this debate hasn't even started. I've not heard anyone saying that there's a problem between center and periphery. Right now, the entire situation in the tribal areas of Pakistan is framed in the war on terror. No one is talking about the rights that those people are demanding in Balochistan, for example, which are now converting into a full-fledged war for independence. Seamlessly, without rupture, something that began for rights has now converted into something else and may soon be something else again.
There are so many issues, and central states have always distrusted tribes a bit because they don't get any taxes from them. They always cause trouble, and they like to regulate them and so on. So that's the common feature. Look what Reza Shah did to the Baluch and so on. What you said about the structure of tribal society, obviously, it's absolutely critical and it's terrible. You seem to suggest that it's really partly responsible because of what happened by the Americans and so on. Other people think it's because of the Islamic groups who, as you say, their first target is to destroy the tribal structures. Whatever it is, how we get back to that situation, I don't know. One of the things that struck me about observing this whole situation is how bad the West and the moderates are in putting over their case. These extremists seem to be extremely effective in putting over the case. I mean, they're blatantly saying this Malala Yousafzai, you know, deserves to be killed. I mean, what an atrocious thing. Have all the leaders of Pakistan sufficiently said how dreadful this is? I don't know. But we are not so clever, the West is not so clever, and certainly governments like Pakistan are not clever in getting over their point of view. And I don't really believe that you can blame the West because it's 50 years ago, or the aid. I mean, frankly, we can't tell the government too much to do what to do with aid. Then we're being accused of trying to dominate the country. My view has always been that we shouldn't have gone into Iraq, that we should get out of Afghanistan, that basically the countries like Pakistan and Afghanistan have got to run themselves, and because the people don't want to live under this extreme rule, eventually they'll sort themselves out, but it'll be a slow process. I agree, there's no easy answers.
Thank you, Lincoln.
Sorry, it's a statement rather than a question.
Thank you, Lincoln.
What do you think? Is it the West or is it the Islamic people responsible for the tribal society?
Can I? Is this the one?
Yep.
Okay. Sir Barrington has raised some important issues. Of course, he knows that part of the world intimately. He's a great friend. And he's right. For me, the analysis is never simplistic. So I'm not saying we blame the West, as a lot of people in the Muslim world will say, or to blame the Muslims for what's happening in the Muslim world. I do not accept this rather simplistic frame of looking at the world today. We are living in an age of globalization. Everything is interconnected. One thing over here is going to affect things over there. If there's something dreadful happening, I may have given a rather gloomy picture. There are also many, many positive things happening. There's so much happening. These incredible women who are being courageous, who are establishing NGOs and schools in spite of all this that you're hearing in the media. What Sir Barrington rightly pointed out was that the mainstream have failed to really convey what's going on there. And that I agree. The Muslims need to be much, much more visible, much more vocal, especially in the media, because otherwise you're really leaving the field to the extremes. And that's what you hear all the time, you know, the binary extremes that we've been talking about. And that's why the role of people like my friend here, Dr. Tahir Kamran, becomes so crucial. Scholars who are in the West who are able to talk, give seminars, and communicate the reality on the ground. It is very complex, Nicholas, and there can be no simple solutions. These are, as you know, ancient societies, complex societies, and going through a lot of change, as indeed are we here in the West. We're also going through, we don't have that same kind of confidence or the same kind of vision or even the desire. That there's a feeling in the West that enough is enough, you know, bring back our boys, and why the hell should we be stuck there? There's also that feeling. Yeah.
Juliet, and then the gentleman, and then the lady.
Thank you very much for a riveting talk, which I found actually also very complex, and I can't really think enough about it until later, so to speak. So I'm just really asking for a couple of clarifications, part of which was addressed by the last speaker, but it also links back to Andy's point. I was thinking back to outside the framework of the war on terror, to the treatment, for example, of tribals and untouchables, Dalits in India, who altogether I think make up about 25% of the population and are pretty much marginalized and pretty much treated appallingly. And I was thinking back to, I think there was an argument or disagreement between Gandhi and Ambedkar, and this goes to Andy's question. Gandhi thought we must give to the Dalits their rights, the human rights, their legitimacy, etc. And Ambedkar's argument was, no, they must take those rights. So they must be, it must be an organized from within themselves, and hence talk them out of Islam. and into Buddhism. And so that goes back to Andy's question about where do we start to think about how to work this? And that seemed to me just one of the questions. And it predates the War on Terror. I mean, the War on Terror has obviously, you know, if you think that Ouija's are in Guantanamo Bay, you think the world's gone mad in a way. Because what could they possibly have been doing? landed them up in Guantanamo, if you see it, you know. So those are just really points of clarification while I think about your whole talk. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Frankie, there's a place out here in front. Come along. He's my American assistant. Great guy. Doing his MA at Cambridge this year.
Professor Ahmed.
Frankie Martin. We let him go with great reluctance.
Professor, thank you. Professor, you've chosen to focus on the impact of the war on terror on women. And from everything you've said, you could equally have given talks on the impact of the war on terror on children, on the elders, you know, senior elderly people, whatever, and even, I think, on the young, you know, young men particularly. So I'm wondering whether there is the war on terror is against tribalism as such, and that what we have here is a contest, if you like, of primary values, because it seems to me that nothing is so dissimilar from the essential values you described as characterizing tribal life as that of modern Western capitalism. So isn't this basically the tension, with all the injuries, women included?
That's a great observation. You're absolutely right. I could have talked about the impact on men, on the elderly, on children. In fact, I have, in this book I mentioned, The Thistle and the Drone. We have looked at 40 case studies across the world and the impact on every part of society. For this particular lecture, obviously, because we are situated in the gender studies department or center, we want to focus on gender and women and to tease that out and find out how we can focus and therefore come up with some solutions. In terms of what we do about it, that is something that I believe can only come about if we understand the nature of these societies. And that's where I would differ from you. The societies we are talking about are tribal. That is a category in the social sciences. These are not societies based in cities or urban areas or agricultural peasants. These are people living according to a code. They've been living there for centuries. They have been living, by and large, outside the central government and its laws, the civil and criminal procedure codes of the, for example, the rest of Pakistan. They don't apply to these tribal areas. And if you look at the societies that I mentioned, all of them will have the same characteristic. And that's what makes them different. And when you correlate that with the war on terror and the drone strikes, they're all happening in these very tribal societies. So again, that's another very interesting correlation that emerges. The segmentary lineage system and the drone strikes. Just think of where the drone strikes take place. They're all tribal societies.
Thank you. I've found that fascinating. And I'm quite astounded, really, at the parallels that we can draw with the impact of the war on terror in women in Pakistan and actually the women in Muslim communities in this country. Because what we have seen with grassroots communities, particularly since 9/11, are the fact that women here are being increasingly pushed to the margins with extreme interpretations of faith, if you like. Many women are choosing to opt out of the public sphere because they believe that that's what faith demands of them, or that extreme interpretation is being imposed upon them. And statistics certainly show that, you know, although illiteracy obviously is unacceptable in Pakistan, but here in the UK, Muslim women are at the bottom of educational achievement. They're least likely to be employed, and they're most likely to suffer from mental health issues as well, with regards to honour. You know, young men are openly discussing the fact that, you know, women that don't wear hijab in the UK, you know, it's justified to rape them. These conversations are going on with young men that I know in the UK openly on forums. Such has been the sort of impact, if you like. And this, you know, we live in a Western liberal democracy, but the model of Islam that you are talking about is not one that I see practiced here. Now, even in the very small city that I work with, I hear weekly of imams in local mosques telling young men and women that Western education isn't important. It's not the path to heaven. And if they're being taught by a female teacher, their eyes will burn in hell. That's happening on a daily basis. We haven't had a suicide bomber, but we've certainly had one young woman who went and stabbed her MP because she'd become radicalized. And increasingly, what I'm seeing is now women are being given their identity through their religion. That is what they have to fight for, but not in the public sphere, in the terms of they're being told that you have an obligation to establish a caliphate, and women in the UK have a role to play that. So they're coming back from the public sphere, but giving this very hardened identity. How can we tackle that?
Thank you for that observation, and thank you for giving us such a graphic picture of the challenges that Muslim women in the UK are facing. The picture I built up, as you say, doesn't match the reality, simply because what I pointed out was the ideal. Every religion, every culture has an ideal. Today, in the post 9/11 world, the United States is often seen in a rather negative light in the Muslim world. Yet, if you read of, and I would urge you to do so, of the founding fathers, Washington, Jefferson, Franklin, you really read and get to know some extraordinary human beings who are trying to create a new world, which really is a world based in pluralism, enlightenment, and civility. Washington's only book that he writes has civility in the title. So again, the reality and the actual, and that's the challenge every society faces. As far as these imams are concerned, you know, this is something that is not new. When I was here in the UK in the 1990s, very often I'd be challenged or attacked by some of these same characters, and some very well-known guys, for example, Sheikh Bakri. I don't know whether he's still around or not. But he attacked me publicly, and they would denounce someone like me, and we had many friends working in my position. Malik Saab, Ashraf Saab, I see them all. These are stalwarts of the community. But we stood up to them. When I was invited to the first speaker ever to a synagogue, the St. John's Wood Synagogue in 1999, I went down again with these gentlemen. We had lots of Muslims. I took about 40 Muslims, including some imams, and the first Lord, Lord Nazir Ahmed, he had just been made Lord. And the next day we were attacked again by these people, that the Muslims have been to a synagogue, therefore they should be excommunicated and attacked and so on. But we stood our ground. We countered by examples like the one I gave you, of the Prophet, of Islam, or what the Quran says. And we held our ground, and we saw them off. So this is a battle that the English, the mainstream English, can't fight, because by involving them, you're going to confuse them. And maybe in the end, it'll be counterproductive for you. You have to fight this battle within your society. You must not back down, and you must fight it on a theological basis. Because what they're doing is intimidating you. It has nothing to do with Islam. It is culture. And it is ignorance, and it is unacceptable, the kinds of things that they are suggesting women be subjected to. This example in Swat particularly upsets me, because my wife and family are from Swat, and it's very close to home. So we cannot do it, because the stakes are very high. If you give up, if you lose, it's not only that Britain will lose, but in one sense, the larger world of Islam will lose. So this is a battle that you'll have to fight. We have Dr. Hoti here, who's in fact been fighting this battle, creating women's schools. She was the first director of the only Jewish Muslim center at Cambridge. And she had some threats and she had some nonsense said to her, but she stood her ground. She had the Archbishop, the Chief Rabbi supporting her, and is now doing the same in Islamabad. Amni, do you want to make a comment on this? To cheer up our sister here, she's to show her that your father is not completely...
Thank you. Well, I want to say that my work on Muslim women, it was really a PhD on Pashtun women in northern Pakistan, was really inspired and supported by my father throughout. So not all Muslim men are, you know, we don't have the negative stereotype. In fact, he's been a tremendous source of support. But really, I was doing my work on a society, really largely a tribal society, where women often withdrew from education. Just like, unlike Malala, they withdrew from education in the primary level, so about year 6 or year 7, due to parda reasons, so because it was a segregated society. And in fact, a lot of anthropologists who did work on the society painted the picture of women in the society as marginal and even ghost-like. But when I did extended work, about 10 years of research on these women, I was stunned by the centrality of women's roles in making and breaking social relationships and really maintaining the fabric of society. So they were playing a key role in society. And this was a different picture, a different perspective to a lot of what male anthropologists had painted of that society. And I challenged a lot of male anthropologists, including my father.
You see, we have very cheeky women in our midst.
But currently, I'm hoping to set up a center in Islamabad, which will increase tolerance, but will focus especially on women and young people. So we have a lot of supporters here, and hope to start somewhere.
I think there's a question. Just
I have a short comment before that. Also, when you're looking at Muslim women, it's so easy to categorize in the Western societies. And when Muslims do something, it's their first identity, right? So it has to be because of their Muslimness. It has to be because of their Islam. So if a Muslim woman goes and, you know, stabs somebody, it has to be because of her Islam. Then maybe she has a bad marriage going on, or maybe she has psychological problems, or maybe, you know, she has some issues. No, it can't be because of that. It has to be because of their Islam. So I think it's also like when you're fighting something that you don't like in the society, I think it's also important to be very impartial about it and make sure that you don't necessarily attacking them just assuming that everything just comes from Islam. There are a lot of other factors in our lives and in our societies, and it can't be only because of Islam that we do everything. Given that, my question was more about aid in Pakistan and like Western aid. So I think I'm also into microfinance right now. But I think one of the biggest problems with aid is given such a debt, just give the aid and it will solve the problems. And it makes it, I mean, it's like a number one policy in public policy that if you give the aid directly to a government or an army, then they are responsible to the people who give the aid, not to their own nation. That kind of increases the gap that you were talking about between the center and the periphery. Because they get the money from abroad, they just have to respond to their needs, which is just about the war on terror. And also, when they give aid, they usually think about just, how microfinance turned into an institution where people, commit suicides because they cannot pay it back. So it's given such a way that, also the amounts that are given are, when you think it's, millions of dollars, people think it's a lot. But at the same time, you actually, per person, per capita aid is actually very small. So my question was to you more on that ground. Can you clarify that, yes, you Western countries give aid, but they just give it to get what they want, not necessarily to improve those countries at all. And that makes the governments weaker, armies stronger, and the clashes within a society bigger.
Well, yes and no. Again, we have to be very careful about making everything simplistic. A lot of aid is given specifically for health, for education. Much of the aid, in fact, does make an impact. I've been giving you examples of these schools that were run very successfully in a country like Pakistan. At the same time, I agree that a lot of the aid simply is for military. It's for hardware, it's for tanks and helicopters, which I don't think in the end benefit anyone and, in fact, do a lot of harm, not only to the local people, but also certainly to the tribal areas, which are very much resisting the central government. These issues can only be clarified and improved once the debate that we're having becomes a national debate, and these issues are known and discussed and debated. So we very much are at the threshold of this this particular discussion.
We have time for two more quick questions, one here and then one.
Thank you. You spoke very powerfully indeed on how this violence by the centre on the periphery is affecting the periphery, but I wondered if you could reflect some more on what it's doing at the centre. So what is it doing, for instance, to how the army is perceived in Pakistan? What is it doing inside the army? And what does that mean for Pakistan as a whole? What is it doing for how Islam and nationalism are interconnected? And how do we see, for instance, minority groups, intolerance and persecution of minorities? Is that part of this story?
This is an excellent question. Of course, my focus was on the tribal areas and the periphery, therefore I focused on it. This is a very good question, again, in the book, which is taking the whole picture. Therefore, it would include the center and what it's doing to the center. No national army sets out to rape its own people or to kill its own people. And the impact of actions like that on it are devastating. I have known soldiers, there have been colleagues, friends, relatives, Pakistanis, very fine, outstanding, courageous, noble officers in the Pakistan Army who gave their lives in many instances. And yet, when these actions took place, they were in complete despair because they believed it violated everything they thought that an army should be, a soldier should be. This is not the remit of the soldier. So the impact of the soldier can only be calculated on a psychological level. And it is not surprising. It is not surprising, I'll give you a startling figure, which some of you may know, that in Afghanistan, Sir Nicholas Bankton said we should get out of Afghanistan, more American soldiers have died by committing suicide than killed by the Taliban. Now, that's a remarkable statistic because Americans don't go around killing themselves. It's a very optimistic society. It's happening because these soldiers are landing in a situation. It's the longest war in history. They don't know why they're fighting, how long they're going to fight. There have been so many mistakes being made. One moment it's one policy, another policy, and the impact on them is devastation. Now, these national armies follow this thing through in the tribal areas in Waziristan. There was a point when the Pakistan army was very, very popular in Pakistan. It is a powerful and popular institution in Pakistan, seen as stable and ultimately patriotic. And then you have the military governments, and then the army's reputation is tarnished. This particular invasion into the tribal areas has completely ruined its reputation in the tribal areas. There, the army is declared non-Muslim. Now, this is devastating for an army that prides itself on being an Islamic army to be seen as non-Muslim by the local people. So when a soldier dies, the local mullahs would not allow them an Islamic burial. Now think of the implications of that. Think of the implications on the soldiers being torn apart by the fact that they're killing fellow Muslims, they're not fighting an enemy, they're fighting their own people, and that what they're doing is neither Islam nor is it nationalism. And now apply this to Turkey with the Kurds in in the eastern part of Turkey. Apply this to Yemen, to Somalia, and all these situations where you have the center versus the periphery, and the army being used to do these acts. Gaddafi, Saddam, they all used the army not only to torture people, to rape their own women. A soldier raping ethnically one of his own has some link somewhere with that particular woman, if not religious, maybe an ethnic link, and is aware that something terrible is happening. He's violating all kinds of moral codes. And that impact ends in the corruption and, I would say, the moral collapse of these armies, and that's where we are today.
On the left.
Hello. Thank you for that speech. It was very, very enlightening. And actually, as an Iranian Kurd, I'm definitely familiar with some of the concepts.
You're an Iranian Kurd?
Yes. Yes. I was going to ask you about sort of the concept of tribalism and the mismatch you mentioned between the state structure and actually what's going on underneath. For me, in my own experience, I feel that it almost extends beyond that, in that tribal structures are even looked down upon, and there's a sense of, you know, distaste and skepticism for that sort of, you know, even uncivilized sort of ways of working. do you feel that that sort of exacerbates tensions, and can that even account for part of the breakdown between the rapport, because simply, you know, they're left to their own devices because they're primal, as some attitudes I've definitely encountered myself?
Well, thank you for asking that question. Thank you for being here, because you're basically the focus of this talk, the Muslims on the periphery. Frankie, interview for the book. Now, let me first of all start off by saying that I deliberately started the book by giving a list of those tribal peoples who have contributed to history. And it is an incredible list. You'll have Sufis, you'll have scholars, you'll have figures like Ibn Khaldun, one of the greatest historians of all times. In South Asia, Nicholas, this will surprise you, the president of India, did you know he was a Pukhtun, a Yusufzai? An Afridi? You see, very few people. Did you know this? Zakir Hussain was a Afridi? Yes, yes. Imran Khan, the great cricketer of Pakistan, now a politician. We can name you hundreds of names of people from tribal societies who made a huge positive... Beg your pardon? Now, Nicholas. Barki. They made a huge impact on societies generally. However, the reality is that this very difficult relationship between the central government and the periphery means, as our young colleague has said, that the center deliberately creates a cultural milieu in which it looks down on the periphery. So they're barbarians, they're hill people, they're savages, and you don't have to go far. English history and its relationship with the Scots tribal people, classic tribes, clans, the code of honor, exactly like the tribes I'm talking about, and the relationship was where the English over centuries had a very negative way of looking at the Scots. The positive development is that we've reached a stage where the Prime Minister of Britain can actually talk to the First Minister of Scotland and decide whether Scotland stays or leaves the Union. I think that is incredible. That is how the periphery and the center have to be talking to each other. So I would say that that very negative, deliberate depiction of the periphery makes a difference, because that young generation growing up in the periphery has nothing to look to. They're growing up, your Kurds, as you know, in Turkey, for example, they're told in school that Kurd children have they're monkeys without tails. They're told this all the time. Or they're called savages. In each one of these societies, Somalis in Kenya, even in South Asia, a lot of these tribal groups are looked down upon and seen as cannibals or savages. Or in the Burmese diplomat in Hong Kong giving an interview about the Rohingya people actually said this. He was giving a press conference about the Rohingya who are being persecuted in Burma, and he said, "You see, they're not human, they're savages. And they're not as handsome as me, and they're not as fair as me." Now, he was obviously a rather modest man. But that's the kind of depiction of the periphery.
Can I just say, we're going to have some drinks which will be available at the end over there. And please feel free to join us for further, more informal discussions. I would just like to thank again Professor Akbar Ahmed for the most enlightening talk. And for me, what really struck me was the fact that geopolitical knowledges are often seen as masculine knowledges, and what's going on we see in relation to men or, you know, neoliberalism. And here you're really, you know, deconstructing that and saying you can only really understand what's going on there by seeing the relationships between men and women and understanding those kind of gender dimensions as well. So thank you very much.
Thank you.